Welcome on to the Dunked On Basketball Podcast after an amazing weekend of basketball action and Rockets Clippers.
And Rockets Clippers.
What's up, Daniel? Were you able to stay awake during the second half of this game? That is the key question, the Rockets Clippers game.
Stay awake, yes. Stay engaged, not particularly.
Yeah, I got to admit, I checked out for some Mother's Day festivities about halfway through the third quarter because this was just more of the same. But we'll get to that game a little bit more. We have yet another Bulls-Cavs classic. Danny, you told me you rewatched the third and fourth quarter. What did you take away from that second viewing?
A lot of Cleveland's possessions were really stagnant, especially really late in the game when they were holding on to a small lead, and that's going to be a problem against a lot of opponents. I mean, it should have been more of a problem in this game. There were certain plays that I was really impressed with what Chicago did, and they had other ones where I give credit in the fourth quarter to Cleveland's defense that they couldn't get a good look, so they had to take a hard look. But I thought it was closer to what I would expect from Cleveland on the aggregate. And there were also, I could go on a tirade, I know it's mostly your issue, but the charge that Derrick Rose took on LeBron James, not saying it was a bad call necessarily, but that is exactly the type of action that I think a rule should prevent, because he wasn't playing defense at all, and it was a very possible injury for both guys.
Yeah, it really, and this will be, at some point, I promise, the subject of at least like a 10-minute segment, if not more, on why the charge rule needs to be performed, but not performed, reformed. But the biggest reason for that to me is I just hate watching guys do things where the primary reason they are doing it is to make the referee blow his whistle.
Yep.
The point of fouls is to provide a penalty for when you are impeding the flow of the game. And really, not only a penalty, but to provide a deterrent for doing that in the future, both fouling out and the fact that now you're going to have a foul and probably have to shoot free throws. So whether it's jumping in front of someone and trying to fall down and make the referee blow his whistle instead of actually stopping him from making a basket, or whether it's faking a guy into the air, jumping 3 feet sideways, trying to make contact and draw a shooting foul. Any action like that where you're not trying to actually win the game, but you're trying to make the referee blow his whistle, that to me is what I find objectionable, and I think that that kind of call-seeking behavior is what we should try to curb overall in basketball.
And
not to mention the fact that dudes get injured on the block charge all the time.
With the most prominent to me this year being Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant was injured one of the times on a completely unnecessary charge attempt by Maurice Spates.
And let's make it clear here, too. I'm not saying that guys who undercut people on charges are dirty players.
No.
Or that they're doing anything wrong. And I'm not even going to say that the referees are at fault either. It's the league saying this is what a charge is going to be. And the referees enforce that. It is an issue at the league level much more than it is both the players or the referees, because they are just responding appropriately to the incentives that they are given.
Exactly.
And to continue the list, LeBron sprains his ankle on a block charge play there. Jabari Parker tore his ACL trying to avoid a charge. I mean, because that's one of the big reasons it leads to injuries is not only the impact, but that guys have to contort their bodies in very weird and unnatural ways in a direction away from their momentum, and that's just a great recipe for a knee injury. So anyway, off the soapbox for that, on that for now. Another topic is, I said on our last show that I thought the Gasol injury might be a good thing for the Bulls. They had some good stretches in this game, but also, this was a hobbled Cleveland team that still beat them. Gasol didn't play. The Bulls had two really rough offensive stretches. So what do you think? Was I right that the Bulls were better off without Gasol in this game, or would he have helped them and they win this game if they have him?
I think it helps that he was out. I mean, we saw Nikola Mirotic, he didn't have a great statistical game, but the Bulls played better when he was on the floor, and we talked after Friday's game about why that happens, because of the way that it changes the shape of Cleveland's defense. So, and there was a point where in the fourth quarter, I believe it was, when Taj Gibson banged his knee, and at that point, then you're starting to get in-depth issues because Joakim Noah, again, you know, he isn't himself in that sense. So at that point, yeah, it'd be nice to have him. But you don't look at the last, you know, couple minutes as a representation. You look at the whole game. And I think that the more minutes Taj and Mirotić play, the better.
Mirotić, 18 minutes plus 8. Once again, the best of any player on either team. So that was you know, and the way he spaced the floor, they were able to score pretty well, even though his shot was pretty off.
And he had a huge defensive play against Mozgov. I think it was about 3 minutes to go, and Mozgov had a kind of an open path on off a pick and roll, and he just got stoned by Mirotić. And it was one of those emotional swing points. I think the Cavs could have gone up something like 7, and he stoned him. I think the Bulls got a decent look the other way, and so, you know, he's not a great defender, obviously, but that was, you know, you can see those guys, you can see him pull that out sometimes.
Everyone is saying, well, Gasol would have really helped their offense so much. He certainly was good on the pick and pop in game one, but the Cavs adjusted to take that away in game two, and Gasol has had absolutely zero success posting up against anyone on the Cavs in any of the games that they've played this year, going back to that first game of the year that they played when I think he was like 5 out of 17 or something. And so now you consider that the Bulls only gave up 86 points, and they had an amazing stretch in the third quarter. They only gave up 12 points all quarter. No way that happens with Gasol out there defensively. And I think Mirotić still, in those 18 minutes, even though he's only 1-for-9, helped the offense more than Gasol would. It's as we've said before, because if Gasol is out there, the defense is going to be hurt, and they have Butler, they have Rose, they have Mirotić, if he's out there. Those guys can score just as well as Gasol can, and the defense is going to be better when those guys are out there. So certainly I think, even in this game, I think the Bulls were better off without Gasol. And when you consider the process, and that, you know, you had Dunleavy, 1 out of 7, he mostly takes good looks. Mirotić, 1 out of 9, he took a couple of tough ones, but had a bunch of wide open shots that he might at least hit a few more of. You know, you had Gibson with 2 out of 7, mostly on good looks. So those guys, really, I think the process and the shots generally for the Bulls were good, although they certainly had some bad moments.
Yeah, I'd say that's definitely fair. Another dynamic with this, I brought up Mozgov, is that Mozgov played the fourth quarter, thought he
was
good.
He was unbelievable in this game.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of his, and he'll be on this team next year too.
And he had 15 points on 9 shooting possessions, plus 7, 3 block shots, and a ton of intimidations at the rim. The Bulls were terrible at the rim in this game. And that was another thing where, especially guys like Noah just could not score over him to save his life. And despite having plenty of chances when he would get the ball and be able to penetrate on the pick and roll or have an attempt off an offensive rebound. So yeah, Mozgov to me, this game was about Tristan Thompson and Timofey Mozgov bailing out the Cavs. And, you know, J.R. Smith also, to a certain extent, he got hot at the start of the fourth. And then also just the Cavs being able to get to the line. And they went 23 out of 24 from the line. But in that first half is when they really made a lot of hay. I think they were 15 out of 16 from the line. Irving was able to get there to go 8 out of 8, even though he clearly just didn't have anything going at all tonight. So that was really, to me, the Cavs bailed out what was another really bad LeBron performance until really the last minute of the game.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you can use with this is that of LeBron's makes, 70% of them in this game were unassisted. That's ridiculous. Like, even LeBron is a solid one-on-one creator, but and a lot of those were, you know, shots that were all right, but not he could do better. And you have Kyrie was obviously limited, so that means your other creator, kind of your second primary, is limited. But it's hard. It makes it a lot harder for your offense to go if one guy's basically dominating it and not being that peak LeBron.
The key stretch of this game was at the start of the fourth quarter when LeBron went out, and the Cavs actually moved the ball during that period. You know, big shocker, right? With LeBron out, he wasn't dominating the ball. They actually moved it. They got some pretty good shots during that period. Smith was able to heat up, and that's really when they surged ahead and then were able to scratch and claw to hold on to the lead. But really, it's just, you know, you thought the Cavs might have a different offensive plan. And, you know, to be honest, like, I think that it was just the Bulls playing poorly offensively was the biggest problem in this game. And the Bulls should have won. Like, if you think about it, Irving is totally hobbled. Shumpert is a shell of himself. Love is out. They're playing, you know, J.R. Smith has been okay. LeBron is getting shut down. But just Thompson and Mozgov were fantastic on both ends. And that's what them outplaying the Bulls' bigs, especially Noah and Gibson, is what won them this game in grinded out fashion. But I think the Bulls, despite struggling, I think the process was good. If you play this game, you know, 10 times, I think the Bulls probably win 7 of them. So, I don't know. Do you agree with me on that? Was Chicago's performance worse than I'm giving them credit for here?
I think that is a good general characterization of it, but I also think that a lot of what Cleveland did was, you know, kind of on the lower end of their spectrum. But yeah, I agree with, you know, if Cleveland's going to play the way they played, I think 7 out of 10 is certainly fair. Another really strange thing about this game, considering the talented players, is that they combined for 10 fast break points. I mean, that's just insane.
Cleveland, a very slow-paced team. The Bulls, not a particularly fast-paced team either. Rose, we've seen few of his one-man fast breaks. So that you're right. I mean, I think either of these teams, I mean, Cleveland just with Kyrie hobbled and Shumpert hobbled and LeBron dominating the ball on every possession, I think it's understandable why you're not going to see a lot of fast breaks from them. But I think the Bulls really should have been able to run a little bit more than they have in this series. Another observation that I thought was important before we get into what happened right in the final minutes was the Cavs finally went to the real matchups. When I say the real matchups, that means what you think is best to actually stop the other team. Kyrie, with him being as hobbled as he was, they still started with him on Rose. In that first quarter when the Bulls had 28 points, it became clear that wasn't going to work. And they were hiding LeBron on Dunleavy to start and putting Shumpert on Butler. Shumpert just is not any good guarding Butler because he isn't strong enough and doesn't quite have the length. So once they went with Shumpert on Rose and LeBron on Butler, things changed quite a bit for Cleveland. And after that point, they were able to lock the Bulls down pretty well, also with fantastic performances from Thompson and Mozgov.
Yeah, I think that you're right that was a huge swing point in this game, and yeah, it was definitely an interesting kind of performance in terms of that way when you think about how this will repeat or not repeat for the rest of the series, because this seemed like a very different game, but you kind of wonder what this will carry moving forward.
Well, we'll just do a little abbreviated run through the end of the game here, and started off with 106 left when the Bulls were down 3. The Bulls tried to attack Kyrie and Mozgov, but the Cavs were smart enough. And I say the Cavs because, given LeBron's comments at the end of the game, I'm not sure really who's doing the coaching at this point. But the Cavs took out Kyrie, they took out Mozgov, put in Thompson, and then they ran a double down screen for Dunleavy. Thompson did a great job switching out. Mozgov probably doesn't make that play. Had to throw it back to Rose, and still with plenty of time in the shot clock, Rose took an awful 3, not even close to going in. And then on the next time down, LeBron just ISO'd, ran the clock all the way down, and just went right to the rim and got fouled. That's probably a play that the Bulls need to get a little bit more help on. LeBron was excellent from the line again, although he only got there four times in this game, but he made both of them. And he's definitely feeling it from the line, if not on his jump shot. So the Cavs are up by five then, and at that point, another really nice defensive possession for the Cavs. They switched on to Butler, defended a screen for Dunleavy well. Kyrie was out again, and that really helped the defense. And Butler just made an unbelievable step back over Thompson. He must have stepped back like 5 feet to get behind the three-point line after everything kind of broke down, and he just drained it. His three-pointer, when he's open, has been pretty money in this series.
Yeah, it was amazing. And watching it again, when I watched the repeat, it was really remarkable just kind of how that shot kind of came out of nowhere, because it was such a stagnant possession. Then all of a sudden you see him move, and then once he – it was such a clean look once he got it that you're kind of like, oh, that could work. And then he just drains it, and then that changes it. I mean, if he misses that shot, then it's a 5-point, you know, that's pretty much the game. And so then he does that, and then that gets into one of the stranger sequences I can remember in a big game like this.
And, so the Cavs bring the ball up, call timeout.
Wait, can I add something right here before
that? Oh, yeah, please.
The Cavs bring it up, and the Bulls are just standing there. I believe it was like a 3-second overlap. And so 3 seconds, so there was like, I think it was about like 20, 27 or something like that. And the Bulls are just standing there. They're just standing there. And then LeBron, I mean, I think he was worried about an 8-second call. So he got over with, I believe, 18 seconds left. And they immediately called a timeout. They didn't burn any extra time. He got over. The Bulls guys weren't even that close to him. And then they called an immediate timeout. This becomes relevant.
You mean there's a 3-second differential? So
yeah, 3-second differential.
They were at the point, because they didn't have any timeouts left, they're at the point where they would have had to foul. But they then did an awesome job of denying the inbounds pass twice in a row. And what they did, instead of really manning up, was they just zoned the area where you pretty much have to run to catch the ball. And they're able to deny the inbounds twice. Or actually, no, the second time they got it in and JR was trapped and he had to take another timeout. So then they were able to get it into LeBron through like a long lob pass straight across half court. The Bulls trapped that, and LeBron, I think because he's been hitting his free throws and just because he's trying to take on so much for this team, he wasn't exactly looking to move the ball and get it out of the trap. And Dunleavy and Rose had him right up against the sideline and the backcourt line. And he didn't have any great options to pass to, but you could tell he was just sort of thinking, like, I'm going to just be strong and wait until they foul me. And then he just clocked Dunleavy in the head. Dunleavy did a great job. I mean, that was clearly a foul. Didn't
absolutely.
You agree?
Oh, absolutely. It was a foul. And I mean, and LeBron, I think he kind of assumed that there was going to be a foul, and there were two things. I think one, from what I could tell, and obviously it wasn't the best angle for analyzing from his point of view, it didn't look like anybody had really gotten open in that sense. But I don't think he thought that what was going to happened. And so they forced a turnover by foul, which is actually somewhat unusual from my experience in that circumstance. But it was completely the right call.
Then another advertisement for the no timeout strategy. The Bulls just inbound to Rose. They had no timeouts left. And Rose just dusted Shumpert with a sick crossover, went right to the basket. Great finish over James, although Noah probably would have been there for the tip-in. Or tip attempt, we should say, given the accuracy of his tip-ins in this series.
Ridiculous.
And so then the Cavs had no timeouts either at this point.
According to some people, David Blatt was trying to call a timeout.
Yeah, he was, and so it was Lou who just grabbed him and pulled him back, right? It was, I'm fine with the fact, like, anyone in Chicago who's complaining about, like, oh, like, we got robbed because they didn't call a technical foul on the other coach when he tried to call a timeout that they didn't have. Come on, really? That's, you think that that's like a meritorious way to win a game? like, and you're robbed because you didn't get that call, like, come on.
In fairness, this was a weekend of non-meritorious ways to win games. According to our friend Seth Partnow, and I agree with him. That was But then that gets into the last segmented possession, which also has its own issue with timing.
Well, so LeBron then drove all the way down, got to the rim. Everyone thought this was like a big foul. Mark Jackson said it was a foul on the broadcast, but that Noah fouled him as he went up. I actually did not think it was a foul, because if you look at the replay, Noah jumps straight up and really has him pinned against the backboard. He has nowhere to go. And as Noah jumps, LeBron kind of just powers into him. And then, you know, Noah, just because he gets hit, it causes him to kind of pitch forward. So it looks like Noah is kind of landing on top of LeBron, but he jumped straight up initially. And I thought it was a good no call. That's what the referees are told to look at, is they look at the defensive player and whether he is jumping straight up and down. And if the offensive player initiates the contact in that situation, then they are taught to not call it. So I thought that was a good no call, as it then went out of bounds.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it also, to me, reiterated how difficult LeBron is to officiate. Because seeing it on the replays and everything, like when you saw it the first time, you were just like, oh, whoa. Like, it was just one of those weird things. But when I was looking for that, you know, when I looked for that, you could see it. And it was, I think it was the right call. But in real time, that's just brutal to call. It's just it's just brutal to officiate. I'm not saying they did a bad job. I'm saying it's hard.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, that's why the referees are taught to look at where the defensive man is and how he's jumping as a starting point, more than just like what the contact is. So that, and also I think that call would have kind of been a bailout for LeBron because he had nowhere to go.
Yeah, and then that led into, while in this case it was totally justified, what is always a frustrating thing for me, which is the de facto timeout, which is that, you know, because of the way that they use replays now, especially late in games, they got it. Both teams got a chance to, you know, really go over stuff and do all that, because they needed to know how much time was left, because there was actually, this was a time that it was relevant, because they weren't sure whether the last bounce of the ball before it went really far out of bounds was in bounds or not, because if it was in bounds, the clock almost expired, and if it was out of bounds, then it was what ended up happening, which was about 1.5, but that changes a lot of the structure of the game. So in that case, it was fine, but I actually think that it does happen more often, especially in this game, when neither team had a timeout remaining.
This is another one of these things that people were crying about, and I'm sorry, just to me, is not that big of a deal. This is not why your team lost the game, Chicago. They didn't run some unbelievably awesome play that only a genius coach could have set up with this free timeout. In fact, in those situations, having a timeout really helps the defense more. You can set up your defense, you can emphasize things to them, and statistics show this, that when you have a timeout versus just a straight dead ball, that teams score better out of a straight dead ball than they do a timeout. So it is my belief that under most circumstances, having a timeout and whatever instructions you're going to give to the defense are more important than on offense, because especially on offense, you can just call one of the many baseline out of bounds plays that you have. Not that that's what they ran on this possession.
Yeah, and I mean, we can't say that the original play call wasn't a brilliant call, because according to a very reliable source, that was not what happened.
It was interesting to me. Usually I come down on the side of coaches, and I do, if it's not clear from my comments, I think that LeBron is really taking on a little bit more than an individual player should be taking on, and you know, with the way Cleveland's running their offense and just his incredibly high usage rate in the series and not moving the ball, and the reports that he is kind of coaching the team and hasn't been listening to Blatt. That said, LeBron James is not taking the ball out of bounds. That's apparently what the play called for. Supposedly in Europe, that's what you do, is you have your best player take the ball out of bounds, you know, maybe because he'll make a good pass, but 1.5 seconds, not enough time for him to credibly get the ball back and be any kind of a threat. That's just a terrible play call to not have him at least be out on the floor and work as a decoy, if not to get the ball himself. And he's someone who can always get his shot off in that situation because he can jump over guys and fade away. He's not going to get his jump shot blocked, and he'll always be able to get a decent look. Like, you got to run that play for him, or at least have some amazing decoy action. So I completely sympathize with LeBron on why he just overruled Blatt, and it worked out for him. On the other hand, he probably wouldn't have been crowing that he overruled Blatt if he missed the shot either. So
yeah, the parallel that I made, which is a strange multi-sport parallel, is to Pete Carroll in the Rose Bowl, the game that they played against, USC played against Texas, had Reggie Bush, who was the Heisman Trophy winner that year. He had him off the field entirely for 4th and 1 and gave the ball to Lendale White. And what I was thinking is, even if you want to give the ball to the other guy, you still want your best guy out there because everybody else is going to be paying attention to him. And so you want to do that. And a great parallel that Roger Sherman, who's with SB Nation, brought up that I had totally forgotten, but you might know considering your background, is that apparently Michael Jordan did something very similar to that to Doug Collins before the shot. And non-coincidentally, that was Doug Collins' last year as the coach of the Bulls.
Yeah, I think Collins ended up being fired more due to his, you know, kind of neuroses at the time than that. But yeah, it's... That is a good point, and like I said, if the play call is that bad, I have no problem with LeBron changing it. So
my issue is with him talking about it, not with him changing it. I think that was what, and what's notable. You and I have both covered him for years. Is that LeBron is one of the most savvy in terms of dealing with the media people that I have ever come across in any sport, and I actually covered baseball and football for a little while as well. He's somebody who thinks about all of his words because he knows how they get spun and how they get talked about. And he made a very deliberate choice to bring this up. And that's why I made the parallel to Doug Collins, is that I think LeBron knew what he was doing unambiguously. And for whatever reason, and the joke that I made this joke on Twitter, but I actually meant something similar to it, is that we always see in sports that a change in GM often means a change in coach. And something that people forget about is the Cavs didn't change their GM, but they changed the most important decision maker in their organization after Blatt was hired. And that is hard to sustain. And so it wouldn't be surprising to see the coach change after that.
We'll see. So very quickly here before we move on, because we have a lot to get to, who do you like in this series now?
Cleveland. I think Cavs in 7, but at the same time, you know, it's close. You know, this is maybe a 55-45, not a 75-25.
I like the Bulls, and that a lot of that depends on the injury situation, but with Kyrie looking like this, there's just, and, I mean, LeBron trying to take everything on, he was 10 out of 30 with 8 turnovers in this game, right? Like, and he only got to the foul line 4 times.
He had a Westbrook game, except for the fouls.
And so, really, that's... And I don't think there's really... With the type of... The way that they're playing and who he has defending him, and now with Gasol being out as well, if that continues, so there's better defense now at the rim, I really don't see LeBron's performance getting a ton better as the series goes on, because he's just taking tough shots left and right. So I actually, my pick right now would be Bulls in 6.
Wow.
And if Gasol comes back and plays a lot of minutes, I would change that. If Kyrie is able to get back to where he was in the first 2 games, then maybe that changes as well. But with how hobbled the Cavs are, it would be a major, major disappointment to me if the Bulls can't pull this series out, because the Cavs just don't have anyone at this point, other than the bigs who were amazing in this game. But we'll see if they can keep that up.
And, I mean, if you want to know how close this is for me, before today's game, you and I were talking, not on the podcast, about what we thought would happen in the series, and I said Bulls in 7 with them losing this game. So yeah. That's how close it is, and it wasn't like this game swung it. It's just, it's right on the margin. I mean, it's going to... Yeah. And yeah, I mean, the big question in a lot of ways is health, because obviously Cleveland needs at least one of Shumpert or Irving to have a game closer to what they, you know, what their better games are in order to do this, because this a repeat, as you said, this was a 7 out of 10 game. If Cleveland repeats this performance, they're not winning very many games.
Yeah, my prediction would still be Bulls in six right now, unless the injury situation changes. So, why don't we, let's power through Rockets, Clippers quickly. To me, really, we're not going to talk about the Haka at all, other than to say that it probably wasn't a terrible strategy for the Rockets because their defense is so terrible that it just was clearly better to be hacking him because they are just getting shredded. Their transition defense, absolutely a joke. I mean, they're like made field goals where Blake Griffin would just somehow come down and get it, you know, get the inbounds, dribble in and just go right in and get fouled. He was awesome against the small lineup, which didn't work. We had advocated for that. That didn't work at all. Blake was able to really fight hard for deep post position. And the Clippers are rarely a team that, because of their lack of depth, is going to play harder than the other team. And they flat out are playing harder than the Rockets. They have more talent than the Rockets. The Rockets are just, you know, I mean, this is, after what looked like it might be a redemptive season for guys like McHale and Harden to where the defense was better, it just has been horrible, and they just have all of the exact same questions that they had at the end of last year now going forward. Again, I mean, I think we'll do a post-mortem on their season when it's officially over, but hard to imagine them going forward any better. Also, Chris Paul looked much, much better athletically in this game. He's been able to overcome these hamstring injuries while he's playing through it before, most notably in the playoffs last year. So the Clippers looking quite, quite formidable.
Yeah, and Dwight Howard got double ejected. He fouled out and got a second technical, so well played, sort of.
Yeah, well, I mean, and Howard really is probably the only guy, he didn't play that many minutes because he was in foul trouble, but he's really the only guy looking like they have a pulse on Houston. I mean, they're just... If I were Houston now in Game 5, I would just still go with like Nick Johnson, Papa Nicolau, guys who are just will at least play hard.
Yeah.
And you will at least will like get back on defense. Maybe you're not going to score enough, but you're not going to score enough to score more points than the Clippers with this defense anyway. So, you know, you might as well try something to get someone out there whose heart is actually beating.
I completely agree, and we're not going to go too deep into the summer, but has this series changed your, let's say if you were Daryl Morey, your resolve to keep this core together?
Well, Harden and Howard, yes. I mean, I think Beverly is they could have really used someone with his hard-nosed approach in this series. He's going to be a restricted free agent. We'll see what he ends up getting. It is a relatively thin point guard market, but there also are not that many open point guard slots either. But yeah, I mean, it's probably with the other two games, we should probably hold that in advance for the moment. Why don't we get to Atlanta, Washington? So we'll start with this question. Who do you like in this series now? 2-1 Washington, but no indication that Wall is going to be coming back anytime soon.
I still like the Hawks, but it's another one of those I talked about how, you know, as soon as I picked the Rockets, I didn't like it. Losing to a team, and they were getting blown out most of this game. You know, they didn't end up getting blown out. They ended up getting banked out. But they were completely outplayed by a team that was missing by far their most important player. And any time that happens when the stakes are this high, I get scared.
Yeah, well, I think you can look at Millsap being indisposed, that was certainly a problem. But really, I thought, to be honest, that it was, I didn't get the logic of not starting Millsap, because one of the big themes of the series, which Kevin Arnovich has been harping on a lot, and I think most people have too, who've been watching closely, is that when the Hawks' five starters are out there, they kill it, and any other units, except, you know, the five guys on the end of the bench, apparently, are getting smacked. And so, fine, you wanna play Millsap less minutes? That makes sense. But unless he was, like, literally indisposed at the start of the game, you might as well leave him out there, get more minutes for the starters. I mean, I think the starters together played like under 10 minutes in this game.
Yeah.
And, or at least, you know, through the competitive portion they had, and they actually had a positive plus minus.
And
all other units were got smoked until the that last Mike Muscala led Schroeder led unit. So would have liked to have seen that for Washington. Nene waking up was great. He was playing with a ton more energy. He had a lot of bite and power to his spin moves. He was able to abuse the bigs inside, especially Pero Antic had just no chance. He was miserable in this game as a starter. And, you know, so Washington also just has these previously poor three-point shooters who are on fire right now. Guys like Porter, Sessions even has been hitting. So sometimes guys just are on fire for whole playoffs, like Trevor Ariza was in the 2009 Lakers. He was huge for them in that run. And, you know, Porter, they're running, like, hammer plays for him to the corner. Like, they're actually trying to get him open from three, and he's hitting.
Yeah, and something I want to bring up with Pero is that, you know, the logic of not playing Paul Millsap is that you presumably want to play somebody who's closer to healthy, who meshes with that unit. Pero Antic makes no sense with that starting unit. His strengths, his weaknesses, you know, he got abused by Nene in this game. He can theoretically, he shoots threes. He's not particularly adept at shooting them, but he does shoot them. But he doesn't shore them up in any way. Like, it just didn't make sense to me to do that. I mean, to me, if you're going to play somebody other than Millsap, and I agree with you that I wouldn't have supported it, you go with Mike Scott. I mean, Mike Scott is at least, I would say, a closer approximation.
Maybe so. I think perhaps with the big lineup they had, that with just that level of beef, they thought that Antic should be someone who could defend in the post a little better. But I think if you're getting Washington to post up, that's probably a relative win for you anyway. And you can also double when they have those two bigs out there a little bit better, although that's not something that a lot of teams are as adept at as they were back in the 80s and 90s when double teaming was more required due to the rules. But so I had a couple other notes on here. One was yet another indication where the no timeout works great. Atlanta is down three. Dennis Schroeder falls down, but finds Muscala wide open at the top of the arc. Gortat got sucked in. If they called timeout, Randy Whitman is saying, no threes, no threes, no threes, no threes. Gortat doesn't make that mistake, most likely, if there's a timeout beforehand. But by going no timeout, especially when you need a three, it's so useful when you need a three, because a lot of guys are just not quite as aware in their head of time and score unless they really can have it drilled into them in a timeout. So no timeout, coaches. Trust your players.
Trust your players. And are we going to go straight into now one of the stranger moments of the playoffs so far?
Well, let's save it, because the other thing that I thought was really interesting is that Hawks second unit with Muscala, it was Schroeder, Mike Scott, I think John Jenkins was out there for a time.
I think it was mostly Bayes, but yeah.
I'm sorry?
I think it was mostly Bazemore, but I think Jenkins was.
Oh, Bazemore, yeah. Okay. So they go on a 17-0 run. And they get back, I think, within six with maybe 3 minutes left. They go into the under three timeout, down six or so. You coming back with the starters there, or are you going to roll with that unit?
I roll with the second unit. I mean, they played with heart. They played really well. And the starters had been getting rolled by these same guys that you knew were going to close the game for the Wizards.
Well, so let me ask you a question. Would you start that second unit to start the next game?
No, I just thought, generally, I would play the starters. Generally. But generally, your starters aren't getting their butts kicked by the other team's entire team. So in that circumstance, I don't know what it was. It kind of, it's a hard call. I usually go the other way. It was just one of those feel situations for me. But I think you're on the other side, and I'm usually with you.
I'm definitely torn. I mean, there are a number of considerations. One is just simply, if it's the regular season, I think you roll with that unit. You know, you don't want to bring the guys back. They've been sitting for a little while, which we'll get to a little bit more, too, within the Carroll situation. but that they've been sitting for a little while, and you want to kind of say, hey, reserves, if you do well, we'll leave you out there. We're going to reward effort. You're building the culture, blah, blah. During the regular year, totally understand that. In the postseason, though, I really don't think, and it was a close call for me because obviously the starters didn't play that well, but remember, the starters are still plus seven in this game, I think is what it was, so plus something. And I really still think that for that three-minute period, the starters gave them a better chance. You lucked into this great performance by these backup guys, but, you know, down the stretch especially, that's the other thing, too, is these backup guys, and obviously it worked. They got the tie. And who knows how the starting unit would have done. Maybe they would have done even better. Maybe they wouldn't have even gotten the tie. You know, it's hard to say. It worked out better than I thought it would, frankly. But the starters are the starters for a reason, especially when it's your starting unit with Atlanta that has been a dominant unit all year. So I probably would have gone back to them, but, and I think that coaches just are of the mind where they're just kind of mad at the starters when you're getting blown out.
Yep.
But they're still the starters for a reason. And I still think that over that 3 minute period, once those other guys get you back into it in the playoffs, you want to go with the starters. But I certainly understand the other viewpoint, though.
Before we get into the Carroll thing, the other weird thing with this game that I didn't think about as it was happening but saw afterwards when I was looking at stuff is it's so unusual to see a team double up the other team in fast break points and almost double them up in points in the paint and lose. So the Hawks had 25-11 fast break, 50-32 points in the paint, and they lost. It's just kind of a weird game in that sense.
So the last play, Randy Whitman, again, deserves some credit. You know, supposedly one of the worst coaches in the league. Like, are people going to keep saying that about him now after this playoff performance? After he's, you know, like, whatever it is, like 8-2 or something as on the road as a playoff coach?
He's a sorcerer.
Runs a really nice play. He has Will Bynum, puts him in, I think, mostly just to bait Budenheiser into leaving Schroeder in so that they can get the switch of Pierce on Schroeder. Schroeder did an okay job on Pierce, but he doesn't have the length and he doesn't have the strength. Bazemore did an amazing job of coming over to help out. But, you know, Pierce was able to make the shot. Not a great shot. I completely sympathize with what Schroeder said, where it was a lucky shot and he did a nice job contesting, and that's, you know, that shot probably doesn't go down for Pierce very often, but it did go in, and that leads to the question. I was wondering at the time why Damari Carroll was not in, because he had actually been in just as a defensive replacement on the previous possession when they were in sort of like a trap foul mode. So he wasn't in, and he certainly had an interesting explanation for that.
Yeah, if you happen to have the name of the reporter on hand, I do not. It was this supremely, like, he got asked about it, which is exactly what the press is supposed to do. And
yeah, it was a local, like, TV news, like, sports guy out of Atlanta, and I apologize that I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he shared it on Twitter, and it didn't even show up on my timeline at all. You, like, sent it over to me eventually, and it became bigger news today, but what did he have to say?
Well, so basically he said that that Budenholzer had called for him to come in, and he said that he didn't feel comfortable and that he wasn't going to go in. So he didn't go in.
Yeah, I think it was like he didn't feel comfortable physically, I think is basically what he said. And then there was a further clarification today, which didn't really clarify much else. It basically said that because he had been sitting for so long, he just didn't, you know, feel that comfortable. And actually, I'm not going to greet that with as much skepticism as people probably would think that I would, because, you know, especially now as an old man, when you've been sitting for a while and you try to get up and go out there, it's hard. Like, you're not really, like, it takes you a while to warm up. And you know, and you'll even see guys like on the Spurs, like when Manu Ginobili will check in off the bench, he'll do like a bunch of like defensive slides during the timeout to like try and get warm. It is tough, even if you're an NBA athlete, to come out there after you've been sitting, and especially if you're a guy who's like 29, 30, or even older than that, to just come out and be right at your peak to provide maximum effort with no warm-up at all. That said, though, he had just been out there the previous possession. Maybe he didn't feel right. I don't know, but it's definitely one of the odder situations I can ever remember. And maybe, you know, Carroll deserves some credit if that's what he really said, because most guys, they just go in. They don't want to show weakness to their coaches. They always want to say that they can get the job done. And if they actually have that level of communication, more power to Atlanta, to be honest. If he really felt like he couldn't do it, it's better that he said so than go out there and get scored on.
Yeah, and I'll add in, during the time that we talked about this, the media member who put this out there is Zach Klein. Zach Klein is the sports director at WSB, which is Atlanta's ABC affiliate. So a lot of credit to him for asking the question, and apparently he followed up and got a pretty much a non-answer. So you can look on his trend line. Also, Nate and I both retweeted it after when we put it out there.
Yeah. So anyway, that's about all we got on that game. Maybe we should move on to what I think a lot of people would consider the most surprising result, which was a 99-89 victory for Memphis over Golden State.
Yeah, and there are a lot of different ways to go with this. Memphis played a really good game. The thing that stuck out to me was a very positive change that they still need to do one more, which was that Steve Kerr did something Jackson-esque, that he put Klay Thompson on Mike Conley. But that makes a lot of sense with the way that Memphis's offense is structured. I thought Klay did a pretty good job most of the time on him. The surprising, considering his background, downside was that, in my opinion, and there are certain people who disagree with this, I thought Curry did a lot of overhelping defensively, and that led to a lot of wide open shots. And while Memphis is not a great shooting team, it helps a lot when there's nobody within a few feet of you, and they weren't even getting closes on Courtney Lee, and he was making some of those shots.
Yeah, I think overall during the game, I didn't think that was a huge issue, and that especially in the first half, they should have been helping on those guys in the post more. And when they did move to that more, they were able to shut Memphis down a little bit better. But I know the one play you're talking about in particular, where Curry gave up kind of the back-breaking three to Lee, really for no reason at all. He was just hanging out on the baseline. Lee rotated up to the top of the key, and you know he was 20 feet away from him when he took that shot. Green tried to rotate out there in vain. So that was a tough backbreaker. Another thing that was great about that switching of the matchups, I mean, it didn't do that much ultimately. I mean, they lost the game, but the reason that I think that they did that was more to help on offense than on defense. And the reason that works is, if you think about it, with Thompson guarding Conley, and they pointedly put Curry on Lee rather than Allen, they had Barnes on Allen. Well, Allen had really shut down Thompson in the previous game. And Thompson, actually, I don't know why everyone is saying he was so shook in this game. He actually had a totally efficient game. played a lot better than Curry did, frankly. But the beauty of that was that since neither of those guys were guarding Allen, when they would run down in transition, either the Warriors would get the same matchup if they pushed the ball, or Allen would have to switch on to one of them and they might be able to get a chance to get a good shot before you get there. And they actually got quite a few good looks on that in the first quarter before things kind of went south a little bit offensively.
Yeah, and the other huge thing that it's kind of amazing, we've talked about this game for, you know, at least a couple of minutes without talking about Marc Gasol. Marc Gasol was fantastic in this game. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, you always run into danger when you're talking about these favorites of not giving sort of the underdog enough credit, because you're always talking about, oh, what did the favorite do wrong? But Randolph and Gasol were both awesome in this game, pretty much unstoppable one-on-one for either of them. And to me, there's been a lot of talk about the Golden State offense, and that certainly has been an issue. You would expect them to score better. They missed a lot of open shots. Curry in particular just hasn't been able to get one to go down from behind the three-point line the last couple of games. But even when the biggest reason I thought that Golden State was going to roll in this series is I thought if their offense was working, they'd be able to really win handily. But even if on the games their offense wasn't working, that they're actually as good or better a defensive team than Memphis is, and that Memphis would really struggle to score against Golden State. That has not been the case, especially in this most recent game when they gave up 55 points in the first half, and that's because Gasol and Randolph just totally outplayed Bogut and Green, and even more so the Warriors' front court reserves. And a big part of the problem is just those guys are catching the ball way too low. Green is a guy who, for all of his defensive talent, is someone who has a weakness of letting himself get ducked in. His first instinct is to help, to switch out in the perimeter, and he's got to stay home a little bit more on this series because otherwise Gasol or Randolph are catching the ball too close, and then once that happens, he doesn't have the size to really contest them. He's got to do his work early and then be able to use his strong lower body to keep from getting back down. So he has to play better. Bogut was getting scored on inside pretty badly as well. Azili had some good moments, but then when he was left one-on-one against Randolph, he got lit up. He was comically trying to take away his left hand, which I advocate, but when you do that, you don't turn your hips totally sideways and give him the baseline. You just are a half step over to his left, and it's even more, taking away that hand is more of a mentality than it is even starting off in the body position. So the Warriors' bigs just haven't been good enough. Memphis, in general, has played harder than Golden State, and that, to me, is the bigger problem, the effort and just the performance from the big guys more even than the shooting woes.
I definitely agree with that. Another challenge for the Warriors is that their non-starters have a lot of offensive deficiencies. They have a series of guys, and the way
or
I
defensive
like
defensive deficiencies if it's or de-
yeah yeah they're more in the specialist realm. And the challenge with that against a team like Memphis that's so smart and that understands their opponents really well is that they know who they need to care about and who they don't need to care about. And so when the Warriors are playing, let's say, a unit that has Sean Livingston and Andre Iguodala out there, they know, okay, we can do some different things here. We can hide some players, you know. We can do that, and then we'll force the other guys, we'll force better defenders on the other guys. And you get a lot more of that, particularly in the seven-game series, because you get to see the same team over and over again. And that's why I've been somebody who's supported shifting the subs a little bit. And obviously you don't want to, you know, you don't want to make it so that the whole idea of, you know, changing everything for your opponent, but the Warriors have a good defensive point guard, and it's one of my points of emphasis with this series is that, and this is true if they face the Clippers in the next round, should they make it through Memphis, is you want Stephen Curry on the floor every minute Mike Conley is not on the floor. And against the Clippers, you can do that because Doc Rivers is pretty reliable in his rotations, and you can get that in this series because Mike Conley's still coming back from injury, and he doesn't have his stamina all the way back, so they can't really jack with his rotations too much because he's still recovering from fatigue and building his stamina back up. So you make sure that when Benno's out there and everything, and that doesn't mean that though that guy's necessarily going to be on Curry, but it makes it so much more work for Memphis than if they can just go, oh, we can put Benno out there with Sean Livingston, we're going to be fine.
In fairness, actually, Benno, when he was matched up against Curry, did a great job. He was really intense, a lot of ball denials. I was extremely impressed with how he was able to do it, especially because he got lit up in game one by Curry every second that he was on him, and it had to be taken off. So good job by him. I think playing less minutes allowed him to exert a little bit more energy defensively. To me, going along the theme of my belief that it is more the defense than the offense that needs to improve for Golden State, I think I would pretty much excise Barbosa from the rotation. He has really struggled in that. He had a nice burst in game two, but wasn't able to get anything going offensively. And defensively, when he and Curry are out there together for the second half of the first and third quarter, when Thompson goes out, they're just, the defense is nowhere close to the same with those two guys out there. Just that the help isn't as good. The rebounding isn't as good. The ability to switch is pretty much eliminated on a lot of actions with those two guys out there. whatever Barbosa is supposedly providing, I think just, you know, you have Sean Livingston in there. Yeah, he's not the greatest offensive player, but he can defend a lot better. Give me a little more Barnes, Iguodala, and Livingston, and just move on from Barbosa, because defensively, he's not someone who is going to get the job done. And then I think offensively, their flow offense, it's been beloved. We've all loved it. A lot of defensive teams really struggle to deal with that. But in some ways, it plays into Memphis's hands because they have great guys off the ball. Conley and Allen are both guys who are really good off the ball at kind of holding. They're getting away with that a lot. And, you know, it's not to say there's anything wrong with that. Like, that's, they're doing a good job. It's not being called. It's not a foul. So I think they really need to just start getting a little bit simpler. They're turning the ball over a lot, too, and say, all right, we're going to play great defense, and then we're going to go a little bit simpler. We're just going to put Curry in pick and roll with Zach Randolph. And if someone like Livingston or Iguodala is out there, if going to that strategy won't hurt as much as when you're trying to run all these complex action and guys can help more. You know, Curry and Green, pick and roll. Green had some open ones. Just go with that. You may not have as much of an offensive upside there, but it's a consistent thing that you can do that is harder to take away, and you can rely a bit more on the defense to win you the game ultimately.
And I would run on makes more when you can.
You know, this is one story that I think is very overplayed. I don't think I said this when we talked about game two, is that Memphis isn't winning this by slowing down the pace.
No, not at all.
The number of possessions is pretty close to what it was for the Warriors in the regular season when they were the fastest paced team. They averaged about 97 possessions a game, and they've been, you know, maybe a couple below that, but nothing major. And I think most of that is just Memphis slowing it down. The Warriors on offense actually are taking plenty of quick shots, and really the shots that they are getting early are some of the best shots that they're getting. So I think the idea that they are slowing it down, Memphis, is a little bit overblown. They're just playing better defense, and they're scoring and getting to the foul line a lot, and that is preventing the Warriors from getting great opportunities, but the Warriors are absolutely running on every opportunity, and I think that particular aspect of Memphis' success has been overblown a little bit.
I think they have a few opportunities. Just the basic concept of it for me is just that Memphis's half-court defense is so good that I feel like any chance you have to not get that, you do it. And they're doing it most of the time. It's not, as you said, it's not a slowing down issue. For me, it's just maximization of positive opportunities.
Any other thoughts on this one? I think that's, I'm pretty close to tapped out.
Yeah, I think.
Oh, no, I did have something actually.
Okay, go ahead with that then.
I think the Warriors finally, in the second half, did find a formula defensively, and that involved double-teaming it in the post, especially when Iguodala was guarding Tony Allen. The Warriors surprisingly had not helped that much off of Tony Allen up until that second half, when Kerr actually said in the halftime interview that they were going to have to start doubling because they were getting their butts kicked, and they were able to hold Memphis down a little bit better, aside from the one period at the end of the third quarter where Randolph started killing Azealia one-on-one and they didn't double as much. Yep. So I think with the Warriors going smaller, they had some success in the Green at center unit, although he kind of had some mistakes down the stretch that killed the comeback a little bit. But the defense was able to work there, and if they can just get the communication a little bit better on those double teams, they have the personnel to make that work, especially when you have a fair amount of guys, especially Allen, who is not going to provide the spacing for them.
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing that I was talking about, how Memphis was capitalizing on non-threats for Golden State. That's the same thing that the Warriors need to do. And they started doing a better job, as you said, in the second half.
The other thing was, the Warriors had cut what I think was a 15-point halftime deficit to 8 when Thompson and Bogut both picked up their fourth fouls and were taken out of the game. And I think at that point, especially when you're down by 8 and you're starting to find something, against a team that you really had not found anything against for the previous six quarters. Got to leave those guys in there, especially Bogut. He went out and never returned to the game, I don't think. So he just finished with four fouls, didn't play another minute, right? Is that correct?
I think he came in for like a quick dab, but it was really, really short. He definitely wasn't making a consistent impact in that way. And I thought Azili, when he wasn't getting abused by Zach Randolph in that stretch at the end of the, was that the second quarter?
End of the third quarter.
I thought that he did a relatively good job. The other thing, and we won't see this in game four because Maurice Spates is already out with a calf issue and this might end up being a non-issue, is that I would be intrigued to see Azili and Spates play a little bit together. I think that there are obviously other issues with it, but I think that there are certain things that it could help.
I thought that Kerr really, one of his flaws is that he is too conservative with foul trouble, and he had this kind of traumatic experience way back early in the year. The first game of the year that the Warriors lost was in Phoenix, and they were up pretty handily, and Curry just randomly got both his fourth and fifth fouls very quickly, and Kerr was beating himself up afterwards over not taking Steph out of the game after he got his fourth. And ever since then, he's been extremely conservative about foul trouble. And when you're down, you can hide Clay on Tony Allen, leave him out there for a little bit longer. Like, it's just, if you're up, I can see playing it conservatively, but you need him. He's your second best player. You're really struggling. I think you just got to leave him out there if you're Kerr and be a little bit more aggressive in that situation.
Yeah, and as I said at the time, you know, the advantage with Boga is that you have a more logical, effective replacement. There's no one on this team who can do what Clay does when he's off the floor. So you're sacrificing so much by pulling him.
Tony Allen, of course, was awesome. Had a ton of steals. I guess one other thing too. I thought the Memphis crowd was superior to the Oracle crowd. What do you think of that?
I completely agree. It helps a lot when your team plays really well and when your team plays well in a way that fits in with your identity. To the most part, I mean, they were physical in that sense. You know, they like those kind of games, but their crowd was supportive. They stayed hot even when the Warriors went on that run, which a lot of people thought kind of started having those thoughts like they did in game two. Where it's like, oh, here they come, you know, one of those. And their fans stayed engaged, they stayed supportive, and I thought they were excellent. They were a great crowd, and it added to the atmosphere and everything, and I thought they were great, yeah.
It's always hard to tell on TV, because it's just, a lot just depends on, like, the crowd mic, but I kind of try to judge it by whether there are, like, any unique, specific chants. That first team all-defense chant was awesome. And the crowd was standing a lot more of the game as well. Really just a fantastic crowd, I thought. And it'll be up to the Oracle crowd to rise to the occasion in game five. Last question here before we go. What's going to happen now in the series?
Oh, wow. I mean, I didn't expect Memphis to outplay the Warriors as kind of out thoroughly as they did. I called a split in these two games once Memphis won game two, just because I saw how well they were playing and that they had a healthy-ish Conley. I think the Warriors are going to win it, but I don't feel super strong in that. I think that they've a lot of times when the Warriors have had two bad games in a row, they have a third game that's pretty strong. And granted, playing Memphis three times in a row makes that a lot harder than just three regular season games in that sense. But I think that we're going to see something closer to a standard Warriors game. But at the same time, the Grizzlies have outplayed them in this series. I don't think there should be any ambiguity about that. They've outplayed the Warriors so far. I don't think it's a gigantic margin, but it is notable. So I can't say, oh, this is the Warriors series or anything like that. Memphis has played excellently.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily a strategy issue. It's just the Warriors have got to hit shots, and their big guys have got to play better, especially defensively. That's really what it boils down to. It's whether this is a situation where the Warriors' defense is kind of built for the modern era. They can switch a lot. They have a lot of these guys who are like size. They can close out. They can help and helping to recover. They're really good at helping on drivers at the rim. But this is not a traditional Memphis offense. And this might be the one area where Golden State is weak. I thought that Andrew Bogut and Green would be able to handle those guys. They have not so far. They're going to have to get it done if Golden State is going to go back. I still think Golden State wins this in seven, but, and we may look back on this as a blip along the lines of 2012 Miami being down 2-1 to Indiana. Same thing with, I think in, last year Miami was down 2-1 to Indiana as well. I mean, there are times when teams are down 2-1, and this Memphis team also kind of has a habit of getting up in series and then, teams figuring them out a little bit and realizing that they have to rise to their level of competition and how hard they're playing. And, you know, that's something that happened to, for example, Oklahoma City in last year's playoffs in the first round. So I still like the Warriors, but, you know, it sure is getting dicey.
Yeah, one other small thing I'll mention with the Clippers looking pretty confidently as they're going to the conference finals. We're settled into what will be an awesome Western Conference Finals, regardless of it, not only because of the play on the court, but because the Clippers have a lot of history with a lot of teams, but particularly deep history with these two teams. And there's going to be a lot of personal issues and teams that will have a fun style of play either way. So no matter what, I'm super excited for the Western Finals.
I also think we're in danger of not giving the Clippers enough credit just because Houston looks so bad. And we may have been seduced by Houston a little bit in you know, that first series against Dallas, which probably wasn't really a real playoff team, frankly, the way we thought that they were. And I picked the Rockets in seven. That was obviously a huge mistake, it's looking like.
It could still happen.
Yeah, I guess they technically could. But, you know, the Clippers' offense has just been unbelievable, and they've done a really nice job bottling up Houston as well. I mean, I think this has not been the greatest advertisement for James Harden's potential MVP candidacy, both defensively and the fact that he has been completely acceptably defended by Redick.
Yeah.
Who has done really well and has been smart, but is also, you know, physically does not have the length or the strength to compete with Harden.
Agreed.
All right, that should wrap it up. We will be back tomorrow night. Until then, you can keep up with us on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan NBA. Daniel is Danny LaRue. You can subscribe on iTunes. Just Google Dunked On, and you'll get to the Real GM page. And there's a link to subscribe on iTunes or just in your XML, you know, podcast aggregator of your choice. And we'll talk to you tomorrow night. Till then.